Well, thank you for inviting me here. This was sort of an emergency holographic talk. I was asked about 3 or 4 weeks ago, ooh, one of our talks dropped out, can you make it? And I said, where is it? San Jose. Oh, I'm in town that week. So that worked out great. I am a little surprised. You have as many as 3 invited talks in parallel sessions, and I'm a little surprised that, well, we can't have a gap and have only 2 conflicting talks. So, but we'll make it work out somehow. A little bit about this talk. About 2.5 years ago, eWeek published a list of the 100 most influential IT people. And this was an odd list, to say the least. Some of the names on it were pretty weird. In fact, I wasn't the top person on the list from AT&T. Ed Amoroso and our CEO both beat me on the list. And I suppose it's true. You know, the CEO of AT&T has a lot to do with the world's IT, if nothing else, carrying your packets. AT&T carries about 1/3 of, I think, the US IP traffic. So I was number 98 on the list of 100. Number 100 is Ben Bernanke, who is certainly influential in the IT field, though that's kind of a side effect, I think. And I thought, well, gosh, okay, how shall I use this fame? Sort of like a starlet who says, I want to make the world a better place to live. And I'm not going to envision world peace or something like that. But I thought, there is a problem out there that really needs fixing. And maybe if I add my voice to the growing chorus of voices by various security people, maybe we can fix the awful mess that our passwords are in. And one of the nice things about this is the talk can be given to grandma who has trouble with passwords, or can be given to the people who actually run the authentication system for banks. It has pretty good range, so we'll see how it works. Some of you may have noticed that I have about 115 slides. First of all, the about, I have yet to find a slide program I like that actually counts my slides and puts the real number in there. For a little while, I used LaTeX and that worked, but I really like this presentation better. I wanted to do this in PowerPoint, and Peter Honeyman insisted that it actually had a little macro mark that would know that. It turns out it did until Microsoft bought PowerPoint and removed it. So that feature is not there, and I hate to be the one asking Microsoft for more features in one of their products. This is just, no, but this one is really important. Okay, so we'll have a little bit of fun with this today. I'm all set and ready to go. And we won't nearly fill the hour and a half, and that's fine with me, too. For those of you, by the way, so I have been giving this talk for over 2 years. If it seems really familiar, you're welcome to go to the cool visualization talk, and one of the papers over there is pretty good, too, I thought. So that would be all right with me. Don't worry about it. Okay. Oh, the other thing, some of you may also be noticing that I'm wearing rather unusual glasses. And I've had people come up and say, cool glasses. And I point out, I don't care how they look. They're even cooler than you think, because these glasses have a focusing knob. Now I'm at reading distance. Oh, it's a little too close. There, now the slides are crystal clear, and you're a little bit fuzzy, and that's about how talks should go. So we'll do that. These are great, by the way. I'm not getting paid for this. They're $900 a pair, and they're worth every penny of it. And I even have coupons for 10% off someplace. So I think there's some, you can talk them down a little, maybe. Okay, so let us proceed. Intel says that passwords must be at least 8 characters long, must contain an alpha, a numeric, and a special character, must not contain spaces, spaces are bad, must not begin with an exclamation or question mark. I don't know if there's some old JCL or something. First 3 characters, I'm not sure. Golden rule health, minimum of 8 characters, letter and number must be included, no more than 2 characters, the same, passwords, age, and so on. Wachovia, 2 to 7 to 20 characters. One letter, numbers are allowed but not required. No spaces in user IDs. No, actually, no password, let's go down here. I'm sorry, the password seems to have similar rules to the others. 7 to 20 characters, at least one letter, one number, no spaces, semicolons may not be part of the password. They're bad for some reason. They are case sensitive. At Dartmouth, 8 characters long, not more, not less. By the way, these were all taken off the interwebs. There's no secret stuff here that I know of. Digits can't be a word found in a dictionary, including foreign languages. So Estonian is right out. Reversal of the word found in the dictionary, and so on. ATTUverse, case sensitive, 6 to 24 characters long, must be alphanumeric, at least one alpha and at least one numeric, can't match member ID. The only special characters allowed are dash and hyphen. These are almost DNS rules. AT&T Global Network Services, ALF can contain alphanumeric, no special characters, must begin with an alphabetic character. The Chicago Manual of Style, I guess. Minimum of 5 characters and maximum of 8 characters, and you can't reuse it and so on, and your password will expire. Official airline guide, 7 characters up to 50. Case sensitive. Punctuation's okay, but no spaces, nor a single or double apostrophe. Perhaps you could get shell escapes. Who knows? World of Warcraft. One alpha, at least one alpha and one numeric, must be different. 8 and 16 characters, and can only have capitals. Well, they actually say A to Z, 0 to 9. Those look like capitals. And bang, double quote, hash, dollar, and percent. Department of Homeland Security. 8 to 15 characters, one special character, that's a shift number, I don't know about semicolon, one uppercase, one lowercase, you have to have that, and no spaces, the U.S. government does not accept spaces. CalNet, 9 to 255 characters, I know you're getting the hang of this. You must contain characters from at least 3 of the following 4 character groups. English uppercase, English lowercase, numeric digits, and non-alphanumeric characters, and as an example of those, bang, dollar, hash, or percent. And then there's some other things here, and about changing and so on. And this is the last one, United Airlines rules, 6 characters, case, at least 6 characters, case insensitive. And it can't be things like United and password. So to sum up, this is a visualization challenge. I did this last night, of what's good and what's bad. Many of them tell you whether case sensitivity is there, but not all of them. Some of them are not case sensitive. Some require alpha. This actually doesn't display it quite as well as it should. And some say no symbols except some are okay. It took me a while to find the Unicode for the special space character there. The Apple knew it, but I had to go find out the number and do it. So, first of all, I'm thinking we need an ANSI standard for password descriptions. And I think, actually, the rules would probably be an entertaining exercise for a graduate regular expression class. Though, of course, that wouldn't do it all. So, meanwhile, use a different password on each target system. Change your password frequently. Don't reuse passwords. Don't write your passwords down. Who's responsible for these Eye of Newt password rules? You know, they're sort of like medieval magical formulas. And the answer is maybe I am a little bit. But I never told people to do this. You know, you're supposed to figure it out and do the right thing, and people sort of wandered off into this. So what are these rules for? The users need to know what the rules are for, because if you have security that makes no sense, people are less likely to follow it. For example, the Marine guard who's guarding atomic weapons, he knows why he's there, and he knows why he has to stay awake and so on. But grandma doesn't understand this stuff. What semicolons at the beginning? What the heck is this going on? And so I thought I'd give you a brief view of a declassified 1950s security training film. And we'll just do this. Oh, it was sound.
Open Sarsaparilla. Open Saskatchewan. Open Septuagenarian. Open Saddle Soap. Open Sesame.
There you go. When I log in, I want the orchestra to go dun 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 dun. And you know, we ought to have some whimsy like that. It takes just a little grimness out of what could be a dull, wretched life. And of course, the bottom line, that's Hassan. And if you let him guess long enough, he's going to guess every password. And of course, we've automated Hassan into computers so that if you let people make an infinite number of guesses, the computer will eventually guess your password. And the way to fix this, the thinking went in 1970s, is to make passwords hard enough to predict that the computer couldn't crack it in time. And of course, if you limit the guesses, this game is gone. As Fred Gramp used to say, you've got to get out of the game. And we knew passwords were lousy in the 70s. We certainly knew by the time Dan Klein wrote his paper in 1990 that this was just a bad game. And there's been an arms race, of course. There have been about 12 doublings of Moore's Law since Dan wrote that paper. Multi-core CPUs are perfect for efficiently cracking multiple passwords. You know, you've got N CPUs, you'll get N times the performance for doing it. And can a human choose and remember a password that a computer can't guess when limited only by the computer speed and time available? So these rules came from the deep past, time-sharing terminals, network services that would just sit there all weekend accepting all the tries that might go on. The stakes were lower. And, you know, there were some places like on telephone switches where an entire region would use the same password on the telephone switch. Hypothetically, that might still be the case. Of course, the idea is you're not supposed to get to the password, to the switch in the first place, so it can't happen. But, of course, what are the most current threats we have these days? Keystroke loggers, phishing attacks, and password data spills. On all three of those, it doesn't matter how good your password is. They've got every lovingly entered bit. And if that's the case, then why are we doing the Eye of Newt stuff? Why not just have the password be password and get it over with? By the way, none of these data spills are grandma's fault. And there's a fine paper by Angela Sass. She's written many great papers. I recommend perusing her oeuvre on security. Users are not the enemy. And in fact, the bottom line is it's simply poor engineering to expect a user to pick a password that a computer can't guess given a huge amount of time. That's bad engineering, and it's our fault, not the user's fault. So, of course, the results are that many people violate the rules. Of course they do. The stringent rules increase the use of fallback passwords, which are usually weaker. Simon Byers has a script that you run. You give it your name, and it goes out on the internet, and 70% success rate finds your mother's maiden name. I've been working with some students at University of Edinburgh. Maybe we shouldn't give our information, but have our imaginary childhood friend here make up information about the friend and enter that data. Rules don't make things more secure, and frankly, make them less secure. So where do these security policies come from? There's a terrific paper by Florencio and Hurley. By the way, you want to read everything Cormac Hurley has co-authored, too. Talking about doing a survey of these password rules over a variety of domains, and I'll get back to this in a little while. So I'd like to propose not something we can just use right now, but something we can design for, make the authentication server work. I want one password rule, and it's the don't be a moron password rule. This is something grandma can understand. Pick something that a friend or colleague can't guess in a few tries, and someone watching you type can't guess the first time. Now that would be all of the password rules, and we can make that work. And grandma can understand that, oh yeah, that makes sense, okay. But it doesn't mean you can't pick a word out of the dictionary. Just don't, if you're a cat person, don't put cat. You know, be a little devious, and I think grandma can be that devious. Grandma can understand this. It makes sense. Dictionary words are okay. Simple passwords are okay and easy to remember. You probably don't have to write them down, and you're less likely to forget them, and so on. By the way, I've had some feedback that I'm being harsh on grandma. This is the person I call grandma. She wrote UNIVAC 3 disk controller code cross-compiled on a UNIVAC 1. For all of you kids. But she still doesn't understand these password rules, and there's no reason why she should. So there are other solutions. And by the way, almost nothing of what I'm presenting today is unique from me. The password field is roiling with these comments and complaints. Another solution that just came out in HotSec this year, also there's Hurley again, don't allow common passwords. And the idea is you keep track of all the passwords in a big system. And when you hit about 100 uses for a password, you don't allow anyone else to choose that password anymore. The idea is that you smudge it out. So it makes a dictionary attack much harder. Of course, it also makes picking a password harder. For example, if your favorite nom de plume is Dragon Slayer and you go to Gmail, I'm guessing that's already taken. And in fact, I'm guessing Dragon Slayer 2859 is already taken. So it may be that we're moving the complexity into the username from the password. But I think this is a fine idea to look into. So the summary solution is limit the guesses and lock the account. And I'll get back to locking the account. That's important. Non-moronic passwords. And let's make the locking accounts less painful. And how less painful and how to do that is something I'll get into. Oh, I'll get into it next slide here, right here on number 39. So first of all, there are some minor ideas. For example, if you're at a login session and you type the same password guess twice, that should count as one try. Because you know what you did. You went blah, 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 and it said no. And you said, oh, maybe I mistyped it. My finger might have slipped on that seventh character. And you type it again very carefully and it still says no. If you guessed the same password twice, that's only one password attempt. And that little change would be easy to do in there, and life would be just slightly easier for the password user. Make the password hint not about a secondary password or where you were born or your favorite pet or what was the first street you lived on or your mother's maiden name. Make the hint about the primary. It's my usual strong password, but they don't allow spaces. Would be a fine hint to put in. Another idea, allow a trusted party to vouch for the user. For example, my wife and I share a bank account, but we have different logins to the bank account. And as long as we're friendly with each other, which we certainly are, if I forget my password, maybe there should be something set up where she can sit down and basically bless my password attempts, because she's right there and she can authenticate. The bozo did it again. There are other ways of locking the account with increasing time increments, and this has been in the login program since the 1980s. It backs off exponentially. This is not a bad way to slow down the dictionary attack game without really hurting your thing. You know, even if you lock it for 24 hours, that's a pain in the neck, but it is possible that sometime during the day you say, oh, I remember the password for that one. So you could do it that way. And of course, remind the user of the password rules. If you're going to have the eye of Newt rules, I'd just like to mention that we don't allow leading spaces and no semicolons. And maybe that would jog your memory about what you chose for the password for the account. I also think we need research on account locking. This seems like an interesting field to do it. Unfortunately, most of the data is already out there in people who run these big systems, but it's proprietary. How much money did we spend on user support for lost passwords last year? There are people in this room whose company and who themselves perhaps know the price and know what they tried to do to cut that price down and make things better. What does a lost password cost? And how long will a user wait to unlock? I think there are things that one could do here that could help us design this stuff better. So better solutions. By the way, this talk comes in two pieces. And we're almost finished with the first half. The second half gets into more wild research things. Better solutions, getting out of the game. Well, this was a solution we had at Bell Labs and others had back in the late 80s. Shut up, Norman. This was a challenge response device. You had to log into it with a PIN. It had a DES key. And then you'd type in the challenge that you got from the system, and the response comes back. So here is an actual login from a machine from the mid-90s. And as I actually showed this slide back when it would work. And it says, hello, this is the machine you're talking to. Who are you? I'm Chez. Enter response code for 70202. That was my unique challenge for this session. And I used my little device, and the answer was 04432234. And I entered that in. And someone looking over my shoulder now knows one of the answers that my password provides. Of course, if the question never gets asked again, then the answer will never be valid again. And you can think of different ways. And then it asks where I want to go, and that's it. This, well, okay, so I have to carry this little device around. But of course, you have to carry a device around to get into your hotel room or your car or usually your house. Depends on where you live, obviously. So maybe we should have this for when we log in, USB fobs and so on. Now, I grant you that there are technical problems and people have tried to do that. In fact, people have tried other fobs. The particular SecureNet key I showed, I believe, is no longer made. It went through several companies. Let me know if it's still out there. I still like it. This is the one that won, the RSA, now the RSA, Secure ID key. It's based on time, and it does have a pin that goes with it. Sometimes it goes in the fob, sometimes it goes over the air. I'm not wild about that. But it's still much better than a password. One of the beauties of these is, yes, you have to carry it, but other than a pin, you don't have to remember anything anymore. And that actually is nice, especially if you only have to log in once a day or something like that. And even better, and this is what I use right now, and I'm astonished and delighted that AT&T uses this in our intranet, is the RSA soft key, which implements the same time-based thing in my iPhone. As I understand its implementation, you can steal my iPhone. I don't recommend it. The last guy who did has a record now. But I believe it does not contain enough information for you to actually log in, even if you're the Chinese government. But this is very nice because if you have to carry an authenticator around all the time, the iPhone's already with me all the time. And if this can be implemented in a useful way so that it's safe to lose the iPhone, then this has very nice properties. And I'm quite a fan of this. So, and these are the points I just made. A bad pin just gives the wrong answer. This is very important because this way someone with the iPhone can't just sit there guessing and says, no, wrong pin. Obviously, there are things about that. It doesn't actually know the right pin. It takes the pin you enter plus its answer and combines them. And that's part of the response. And it's the server who decides whether the answer was correct or not, which means you have to go talk to some remote controlled thing that's counting and cares to try the login. That is really important. It's what's wrong with passphrases on SSH, for example. You can tell if you type in the wrong passphrase that it didn't unlock the key correctly. Now, that has some usability advantages, but I don't like that it then gets us back in the dictionary attack game. Okay, so let's see. Forensics can't run dictionary attack, and it means a lost iPhone is an authentication disaster. And I had that, and this was not my concern when my iPhone was stolen. That's a different talk. Challenge response passwords get us out of the game. I don't care if you look over my shoulder because the challenge had better be different. Sniffing is not useful. You can still do man-in-the-middle attacks. There's pretty much nothing to forget, and a pin is helpful in two-factor authentication. It's something you know, plus the device. And they're surprisingly cheap. I mean, these chips are down to nothing. So why aren't they ubiquitous? Because we had cheap devices before 1990. Well, people hate to carry the device. They don't like to do this. CEOs whine, oh, I have to enter the response. I may have to carry multiple devices. My wife carries something I call the big ball authentication, which has the keys for three cars, numerous houses, beehives, and various login things. It's heavy, and it actually damages the car as it dangles from the key. It'd be nice just to have this in one or two places. And he could add two more, yes?
One, you lose the device.
You lose the device. That's, oh, yes. You're off on a trip to, say, San Jose. You lost the device. Now you can't log in. That's right. I should have that in here. I'd change it right now. Well, you know, I have time. No, it's all right. Well, but I will. That's right. Lost device is a pain in the neck, which means maybe we need an emergency holographic login.
Yes.
I'm getting to that. did you have a second point that I should add to this? This is Rick Farrell, who's muttering up here incomprehensibly. The people hated managing the servers for Secure ID. I never worked at that end of it, but you know, in this whole scheme of passwords, the people at the receiving end and the servers, they're the pros. They're the people who go to San Jose to conferences to get this stuff right. They're the ones who give pushback to the vendors and so on. They're the ones I expect to do it right. The data spills are on them. Okay? So I don't, cry me a river about it's hard to administer. Go to the expo floor and tell them, and maybe they'll fix it or write your own. I know you folks do that. It's just the right crowd for this talk, too. This is great. Okay. So no, you still want strong passwords. I've heard this a lot. Now we need them. First of all, there are some circumstances where dictionary attacks still work. If you're a drug dealer and you hide stuff with your PGP key ring, law enforcement's going to attack it, among other ways, with a dictionary attack. But if you're going to have strong passwords, okay, fine, but let's make them fun or at least easier to type. I would like login to be a more pleasant experience. Instead of I have newt rules and semicolons and weird characters and typos. So there are places where dictionary attacks are still a concern. SSH password logins, which I recommend against. I use the public key stuff and unlock the key. Captured Oracle streams and stolen laptops, that sort of thing, can be subjected to this. So we divert briefly for a very short course on entropy. For those of you who cut the entropy class to work at the computing center. Here is 2 to the 10th, 10,024 of the most common British words. Okay, 1024, round number for us folks. If you pick one at random, as in this case, example is the word in the middle, you're not expected to pick it out, but it's there. If you pick one at random, you have now made one choice out of 10 bits. So you've got 10, there's 10 bits of entropy there. Someone who has to guess has to go through, on average, half of those just guessing to find that our password was example. So that's 10 bits of entropy. And if we make two random choices from this list, as you can plainly not see here, the second word I picked was early. Okay, these are common English words, you know how to type them. So you want a 20-bit password, 20 bits of entropy? Example early, we just made. Those are normal words, I can type them quickly. And 20-bit passwords, entropy in a password is not bad. Now, notice a few things. The list of words wasn't secret. In fact, you could use a spelling checker if they typed something that was wrong to go back to one of the lists of words, because it isn't the list of words that's secret, it's which one we chose. The words are easy to type. And one project I'm working on with a student at Columbia is maybe we can pick words on the iPhone that if you make a tapo, the correction tends to go back to the word you meant. Okay, that means trying to figure out how their correction works and find words that are way different in the Apple spelling checker world from what's going on. So if your finger slips in any direction going through the word, by default, it'll always go back to the word you want. So maybe that'd be a little better. Now, of course, you don't actually get to use this Apple spelling checker in the iPhone when you're entering passwords. No, it goes into dots and I have newt mode. Now, how much entropy do you need here? I mean, that 20 bits, that seemed sort of, that's kind of impressive. That's one in a million. Well, according to Florencio and Hurley, Facebook, Twitter, and any company that really does a lot of advertising or has a strong competitor, they want about 20 bits in their passwords. Banks want about 30, and government wants mid-40s and up, and by the way, so do educational institutions. You know, we at this swirling vortex of security despair, we really care about passwords. But supposing you want 60 bits of entropy, this is actually a fair work factor even for a government to crack. So I am now about to show you four passphrases, each that had 60 bits of entropy before I showed them to the world. And what differed was the number of words I chose the word out of. Value part, Peter sent some computer. That's kind of long. I've memorized it now that I've given this talk enough time. But you'd be understandable if you wrote that down. There's 60 bits there. Those were chosen, six choices taken out of 2 to the 10th words. Well, we can go to 2 to the 15th words. That's bigger, fancier words, but fewer choices. Anxiety, materials, preparation, sample, experimental. It's actually longer, kind of a pain. How about a really large word list? Let's take a sample. Bliss, rubbery, unseal, Irish. That comes from a list such that it's 60 bits of entropy, more than any of these guys want. Or you can do what Peter Honeyman did when he got tired with all of this stuff. He just printed it out in hex and carried the word around for a while, memorizing it until he was done and threw the paper away. Now, of course, that's 60 bits. Of course, the problem with this, other than the memorization problem, and, you know, that doesn't look so bad. Well, maybe it does. The problem with this is that many of these don't pass the eye of Newt entropy rules we were talking about earlier. They don't have characters and numbers and upper and lower case. They do have those evil spaces in them. So even if you want to do this, the rules that are trying to make you go fancy are making these much nicer ones work. If you really need the high entropy passwords, these cannot be user chosen. You're not allowed to pick your own six words. However, there's no reason why the computer can't offer you six words and you can reject that particular point, that particular choice. Because you're choosing randomly from 2 to the 60th choices, you could find one that means a little more to you. I'm guessing that would lower the entropy a bit. Well, this is something no one would ever choose, but it's okay. They're going to write it down, and you know, that's really not too bad. Most people are getting attacked from Latvia or Russia, not from the guy next door in the business or the kids in the house. Now, you could have spousal problems where that would be a problem, but you have to think about it. So they're going to write it down for a while. I mean, one of the problems is I need my medical account password about once a year in October when we sign up for new non-coverage. I have to remember, what was the password from last year, and so on. But, you know, for daily use, these might be easy, but who's going to remember them over years? But they're easier to type, and the spelling checking is nice. By the way, for those of you who are wondering, Unseal was a kind of character that was what begat us our capital letters. So maybe a large word list, if you're just a little interested in looking things up, sort of help a little bit, add a little fun. Now, there is another way to do this, and I know people cuss at the computer when they do their passwords. Unfortunately, there's extremely low entropy in the usual password choices. Your top three guesses are most of them. So perhaps you need to be more creative about insulting your computer. And here is a web page available. You excruciating pony of septic red start ecchresis. You hard-featured fistula of podagric macflux. These are about 42 bits of entropy. This URL, www.cheswick.com/insult, will generate 10 brand new ones for you. I promise the entropy source is high and I'm not logging your accesses. Give it a go if you'd like. By the way, this is based on the work by Ron Hardin, who was having the Cray run over the OED back in the 1980s and pulled out, did a lot of interesting studies, and one of them was an insult program, which is this one, you grim-faced pipe of pleuritic snipe sweat. So, see, maybe this would be fun to type every morning. You just sort of, I know what pleuritic snipe sweat is. And 42 bits pretty much meets all the requirements, not the Eye of Newt rules, but of entropy. From the iPhone idea, here are words that tend to be tapo-resistant in the iPhone. Votes, minds, board, alike, yard. Honey, learn, least, lemon, links. That's sort of fun. Okay, well, so let's look a little farther afield for some ideas. I'm going to run quickly through. This is a very incomplete, outdated, and poorly informed scan of the state-of-the-art of password research from academia, and a few ideas from me, which you might enjoy. For a complete survey, Paul Arshad up at Carleton and his group up there have a very nice thing. By the way, these slides are and will be online in my webpage, and I assume Usenix may want them someplace as well. That would be fine. So you can go find the bibliography if you want to chase these down. So one idea, of course, is pass points on a picture. And oddly enough, the fellow at Bell Labs who came up with this didn't bother writing a paper. He just applied a patent. So when you look at the references for all of this stuff, it starts with the patent. pass points. You pick something in a picture, and that is your pass play. That is your password. Of course, do people pick particular points on a picture? Yes, they do. And there are papers that show this from Derek Martin, Merman and Bergeron. There are past faces. This isn't the problem of, I recognize your face, but I don't remember your name. This is, your face is familiar. And what they do is present you five screens with nine faces on each screen. And one of those is, you have to remember the face on each screen that's there, and they're in different positions. I tried this. This is a company. I ran into it in around 2001, but the papers were out a couple years before. It turns out the lady on the upper left is the past face that was mine. I remembered her. And what I did when I ran this was I tried to figure out how long I could remember the faces. So I came back a week later, and I remembered. I came back a month later, I remembered. Came back a year later, and I remembered. Then I came back 3 years later and couldn't remember. So that was, in this highly non-scientific test, some idea of how long this worked. And frankly, I thought that worked pretty well. The other benefit to this, of course, is that you can't write down your password or describe it to someone else. Well, except unless you have a camera on your iPhone or whatever phone you had at the time. Those are my peeps. Another one, you could do this not with faces, but with computer-generated art. And, you know, here's a whole bunch of squares with lots of squiggles and lines and different shapes that the computer generated, and you have to remember which ones are yours. There's draw a secret, and a related one, you can do gestures, like a magician waving his hand around. Not clear how well that could be reproduced. And of course, there's a whole academic industry of the security and usability. You come up with an idea, and then you find 45 people in the grad department of your university to run a test on, and now you have a usability study with N equals 20 on either side. So maybe it's statistically significant. They don't always work very well. Here's another one. You take familiar pictures and blur them. When I reviewed this paper, I actually gave them a pointer to the first blurring, which was Gerard Holtzman's work. And now I will present some wacko ideas from me. I've been giving this talk for over 2 years, and these ideas didn't people enjoy them, laugh, fine, they're okay. But I gave this at the New York Institute of Technology about 2 months ago, and there were reporters in the audience. And soon Google News was festering with Cheswick and proposes, the password of the future may be a map. And this has been quite a thing. In fact, I was interviewed by NPR just a couple days ago asking about this. Of course, they sort of thought it was a pass map, like the point thing I showed at the first one, and it isn't. But here was an idea I came up with, and we'll see how it works. The idea is you have to zoom in on something. It isn't just a location. You have to zoom in so where you finally end up is not really shown on the original screen. Here we have in front of us a standard map of the state of New York, and you can see the Adirondack Mountains in the upper right-hand corner. So I'm going to zoom in on that, and now it's a roadmap of this. Well, there's not much to see there. Let's switch to the satellite map. Now we have a richer way of mountains and lakes and rivers and Lake Champlain and Lake George on the right and so on. And let's zoom in a little more and see what we can see. So I'm following these zooming steps in my mind, and the idea is hoping that I can remember how I zoom in on something. So I zoom in, and now on the upper left is a lake that looks to me like an upside-down dog, sort of a yappy dog. I'm going to zoom in on that. And yeah, it really does look like a dog. It's got the legs sticking up and this sort of weird bifurcated tail pointing down. And right around the center is the dog's head. And where the yappy sound comes from, there's an island. So I zoom in on the island and click on that, and that's my pass point. Okay? Not just a map. This means there's a huge amount of detail, a lot of places I could go. And lots of questions one could ask. Can someone remember this zooming months later? I don't know. Some of my experiments, I couldn't. For example, you shouldn't try this on, you shouldn't zoom in on your family's house when you were a kid, right? You might do that and then go down the block and over to the ice cream store or something that someone couldn't guess. But it's really better to go someplace you don't know. For example, one of these trials, I went to Northern Ontario, a place most people haven't been, and try to find an interesting lake and find some feature there and zoom in. And a day later, I couldn't remember where I had gone. So that didn't work. It might be harder to shoulder surf unless the shoulder surfer is quite skilled. It's not challenge response, so it fails there. I don't know if it's memorable over a year. It is nice for a touch screen because we can zoom in with our fingers going very nicely. Of course, the problem with this is that to log in, I have a stream of data going off to Google, giving me map pictures as I zoom in. So how about past graphs? We'll zoom in on something else, the Mandelbrot set. And I'm about to present to you what, as far as I know, is the first practical use of the Mandelbrot set. So I'll zoom in a little on this thing, and let me tell you what I'm thinking in my head. The little code I'm remembering is northeast, southwest. So I'm going to go to the north part of the Mandelbrot set, and zoom in a bit more, and then go to the eastern end of it, and then go to the southern bit of that, and then go out to the west, and zoom in a little bit more, and that X at the end of that squiggly spiral is my pass point. There's probably a lot of entropy there. Now, obviously, highly arguable how much space the Mandelbrot set actually covers or how rich the bit space is. I'd leave it to some mathematicians to figure it out. But I think this probably gives me a lot of entropy. So it's similar to past maps. You could use Julia sets or other complicated things like that. You can generate it right there in the computer. It's kind of fun and weird, and that's not a bad thing. And of course, maps can have a personal meaning, and almost nobody says, remember that great trip we took to Western Mandelbrot? So that was an idea. This is what the press picked up and thought I was talking just about past maps. I actually think this might not be a bad way to unlock an authentication device, similar to the pin used in the RSA key. And I'm contemplating a little iPhone app that just does this. You go and select a part, and that becomes part of the response. And if it's the correct place, and you have to do some digitization, if it's the correct one, then your login works. And I think that might actually work pretty well. So some other wacko ideas. And this comes back from a HotSec talk I gave a few years ago. The situation is this. One-time passwords solve a lot of password problems. It's nice to get a challenge and give a response, but as you have heard here already, what do I do if I don't have the device, the dongle, with me? You know, my cell phone's out of power, I left it at home, it's been stolen or something like that. The equipment is expensive if you deploy it to 20 million people. And the question is, could we come up with a challenge response that someone could do in their head? Now, I'm not talking about solving second-order differential equations in your head. In fact, this has to be pretty darn easy, or it ain't going to work. So I present to you some related work. A baseball game. You can see there's the third base coach touching his face, arm, chest, leg, face. He just sent a message to the first base runner. It contained a few bits, run, stay, that sort of thing. Also contained information to the batters, hit away, bunt, hold, hit and run, that sort of stuff. A few bits of information, but he did it in front of everyone, right out there in the open. And there are people who try to steal baseball signs. It was fun reading the related work. I'm actually working as I read about the history of baseball signs. Pretty cool stuff. But the key to this is that he's obfuscating the thing. And baseball players were decoding this, and it usually works, though when it doesn't, it's quite humorous. Baseball players were decoding this because the obfuscation made it hard to tell which of the various taps and disgusting body touches he made actually were important. And it turns out they have two things that they use. One is an indicator. It says, until I do the indicator, ignore it. And the thing after the indicator, or maybe two after, something like that, is the sign. So the indicator might be touching your nose. So he touches himself in various places and touches his nose. And then if he touches skin on the next one, that means bunt, we'll say. So if he so it'd be nose, skin, and then keep touching things. And that would be the bunt sign. There was also one more that says, forget all the signs I've given so far, the wipe-off sign. So with the indicator and the wipe-off, they tend to contain these things and try to do it. There are problems. First of all, players are under a lot of stress. Some of them are not at the top of their class. Babe Ruth always forgot the signs when he walked out. Just let me run, coach. The information is vital to the game. The players have a tendency to stop looking when the signs are done, even though he's still obfuscating. That's bad. You have to continue staring at the guy until he's done with it. and so on. But could we do something? Humans don't compute well, but they can cut through obfuscation. Could we make a challenge response based in the brain for this? So I tried this for myself. The proposed approach is the computer gives me an obfuscated challenge, and I give an obfuscated response, which is computed simply from parts of the challenge that aren't obvious. And I tried this in an experiment with myself. On the left is the challenge. It has the username, the process ID, and the date and time. And I looked at some tiny subset of that, did some really simple math in my head, and then typed a long string of characters, like 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, B, C, D, semicolon, F, dot, K. Clearly, most of that wasn't important. By the way, it's sort of liberating to have a password where, you know, you type X and V. Those are the two things that have to be there for this time. And all the rest is garbage. I'm typing my password, click, 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 X, V, do, 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 do. You know, no I of newt. No, you can misspell it. You can do whatever you want. And I tried this for about 6 months. After my real login, my shell prompt gave me this. And you can see that I went through here, and most of these were acceptable. No way one is best was correct, slash one. Anyway, you can also see towards the end that my responses got shorter as I lost patience with the authentication system. And in fact, one of the things I learned is you should require obfuscation or the password's no good. For example, the fourth from the bottom, the answer is 4. That's kind of a clue to someone who's going to try to figure out how this works. So it really should have needed to have more obfuscation or the login would not be allowed. Anyway, it seemed to work. The algorithm was not hard. I added 2 digits and added 1 and then took the bottom digit, and that had to be the 3rd digit in the response. Okay? And you could imagine that that people have tried this. And in fact, I spent 2 days on related work. The literature goes back to 1967 because geeks have been trying to do this since the dawn of the computing age. The first one, the paper in 67 talked about a fellow whose challenge was the assembly language instruction and the response was the machine code that corresponded to it. These things are sort of idiosyncratic, but in fact, many programmers in 1966 would be able to do this. I still remember octal codes from the CDC from the early 70s. You know, set A1 to B0 plus, that's a 5110. And anyway, this sort of approach has been talked about with a whole variety of different names. If you want to do a literature search, the paper I wrote on this is useful just for this list, because these are all the different fields that this name has been given that include this idea. I call it pass authentication because the first real paper to cover it called it that. I don't remember who did it. So, you know, pass algorithms, human-computed cryptography, human-aught, secure computer identification, cognitive trapdoor games, human interactive proofs. Possible uses, an emergency holographic login. Maybe you get to do this once when you're in Israel and you've left your dongle at home. Though, of course, if you're only going to log in once, maybe your password is a single character. You know, it's one chance in 26 that someone will guess it. You start doing different games when you do that. Maybe you use it from insecure terminals, such as you're reading your email from one of those public terminals in the airport. Why would you ever do that? And if a good solution was found, now this is one of those ideas that, like ovine aviation, that if it works, it's going to be really great. I mean, if we could come up with something that works this way, and one of the reasons I gave the talk was to sort of fill young minds with the possibility, so someone might say, ha, we'll take Chez's idea and add it to this, and now banks can save because all 20 million customers can do this. It's easy enough to see, we've proven, and we don't have to have dongles around, and it'd be great. That would be terrific. I don't think that's going to happen, and I never did, but it's worth a shot. So there are some problems with this approach. First of all, can Joe Sixpack do this? Well, there's different kinds of knowledge. There's procedural knowledge and informational knowledge. And ooh, I'm a speaker. I get some water, don't I? Yeah, that's cool. So cheers to you all. So that's one question right there. And you might think no. But, of course, Bill Cook, the prosecutor, told me back in the early 90s that 1/3 of his jury members back then were computer literate. That meaning, of course, they knew how to use well, I'm not sure, early 90s is before Windows 98, so I'm not sure what that meant. But maybe what we need is two or three different ways to log into your bank, and you pick the one that either you remember or you find the easiest, and have all three of those pass the security propeller head test of being secure enough. Wouldn't that be pleasant? Then your backup is some other strong authentication technology. Might be something you forget, I'm not sure. There are two kinds of passive authentication solutions. They're ad hoc, which mine very much is, and so is the other one, and they're information theoretic. Yes, indeed, the computer scientists have attacked this, and there are some papers, and by golly, you can tell what the entropy is. For this one, no one knows how to analyze my little thing there that I know of. It's idiosyncratic. It's familiar to me. Does this mean that each of you should run out and do your own pass authentication algorithm, and then your password file is actually a little program? And how do I make sure you've picked a strong one? Suddenly we're solving the halting problem. Though my solution to the halting problem is control C. So information theoretic have strong proof of work factors to crack you. But you have to remember something like 19 numbers. And they present you a table, and you use the numbers and look at the challenge, and you get the response. And if you remember the 19 numbers or whatever it is, you can do it. And you read the paper and say, yeah, that's a 50-bit challenge response that I thought of in my own head, but I had to remember 19 numbers. So as we're rounding third on this talk, I have some updated advice. The first part is for the users, and of course, this is what the press likes to know. What are my recommendations? I have about three levels of passwords. Some sites want me to have a password, and I don't care. The New York Times used to be one. I'm not sure if that's still the case. So I give them the same password, every one of them. And I don't really care if you have my New York Times account. That can be a problem if the New York Times opens a store and starts selling stuff. So these decisions can change under your feet after time. The second level of password, bit harder to guess, inconvenient if stolen, Amazon. I mean, they have technologies that if suddenly I order 10 plasma display screens to be delivered to Sri Lanka, I'm going to be in that loop before the screens are actually in the mail. And then there's a major problem if abused, banks, medical records, stock accounts, that sort of stuff. Now, they all limit the number of logins, but I have a pretty darn strong password for them. I shouldn't need to, and I really don't want to. More advice, write down the passwords if you want to. Who's going to look at it? You have to think about it. Of course, you don't write down the password. You write down something like the password. Make it a little harder. Grandma can understand, oh, yeah, okay. I'll put a space on the end of the real password or something like that. Use variations of your strong password to meet the eye of Newt rules, which is what I might write down is they don't allow spaces at this damn site, which then tells me, okay, I know what rule and how to generate what I want. Save your passwords with Firefox or those sorts of things. I like the approach. I think they mostly are available for dictionary attack, however, if I steal your machine. So it depends on what you're worried about. Updated advice for implementers. This section I often leave out of the talk because I'm not talking to people where the audience might actually have someone who actually works on the authentication end of this. I'm guessing we got a few people here, and I often get useful feedback after the talk. You know, I run so-and-so for the bank, and here's why we can't do it. So updated advice for the implementers. I'll give it a try. Get out of the dictionary attack game. Count and manage the authentication attempts. How many of you have heard of PamTally? I was astonished to find it's been there for over 10 years. There's even a PamTally 2. You drop it in your PAM file, and suddenly all your password logins on your Unix system have a count. And you can do this. It's just there. Now, actually, I didn't like the way it was implemented. And this is one of those things where I'd rip it out and do my own. But it's not a hard concept. And you also want to not just count password attempts on one account, but you want to see where it comes from and count password attempts from IP addresses. Sometimes what the bad guys do, well, I'll get to that. Blacklist inquisitive IP addresses, that's good. Avoid strong passwords in most cases. The authentication server centralizes the security function. That means the people who have to do this are in one place, they know where they are, make it strong and robust. It's actually dangerous to replicate authentication servers because now you need to have them talk to each other and you've got synchronization problems. except for very large systems, I suggest having one server and have it work with a hot spare ready to go. But you may say, look, son, I've run this for 10 years and you can't do that, and that's fine. Don't let the authentication server be compromised. I mean, this is a really simple function. You ought to be able to build a secure computer to do this. You know, this is, if not, go back to your undergraduate school and get your money back. I like the near public authentication servers, OpenID, OpenAuth. This is a great idea. In principle, the crypto ought to work, so we ought to have just a few places out there that do the authentication and have other ones trust it. This is the kind of business that you can do with a trusted company for things. You can imagine banks trusting Amex or somebody like that to do it. I know there have been attempts to do this. I think, in fact, RSA or somebody like that has tried to do it and it didn't work. I think it should work. And it would reduce them. It'd be more like single sign-on for the internet. You're not going to have one. You might have three or four. But it could simplify these things. Identify the authentication server and give the password rules. It's quite possible. We have this internally at AT&T. We've got hundreds or thousands of machines, all from different companies. And it says, OK, authenticate. And they assume I know what system I'm connecting to and what the rules are. No, I need to know sort of a canonical name for the authentication server. This is the ancient SPC authentication server we should have thrown out years ago. Oh, it's that one. OK. And our rules are this. Now log in. Now, that leaks a little bit of information, but it makes life easier for a user who wasn't a moron in the first place. Don't make account names too easy to guess. Of course, what they usually do is they take one account and guess a jillion passwords. Another way is to take a jillion accounts and guess one password. So your authentication server should look for that behavior as well. Social security numbers are a little too guessable. Credit card numbers seem a little better, but I'm not sure. Secret rules. I had a bank. My login at that bank was my social security number. Was it with or without dashes? Well, they wouldn't tell me. That was a security secret. That's taking it a little too... That's just a pain in the neck for me because I'm trying one or the other. Another thing, a PIN is not a password. PINs are digits only. Passwords have other things in them usually. And there are some places out there that say enter your PIN and they mean password. You can have letters in there. That's a bad way to remind people what's going on. A password is a superset of PINs. Passphrase is probably not the right word. It's a passcode or something. But getting out of the game, I've already mentioned this, disable password logins. I have a laugh every morning as some worm or somebody tries to log into my Seismo machine, and I get a whole list of accounts they tried. No passwords work on it because passwords are turned off. In fact, what I do, this machine has a DSA key that it knows about, and it's unlocked with a dictionary-resistant passphrase. So that's the two factors I have protecting my machines at home. If I don't have my laptop, I can't log in at home, period, whether they've got a rubber hose out or not. And that has worked for many years. Okay, let's see. How are we doing here? Wow, it looks like I have one slide left, but I know that's not true. Oh, in fact, there are 129 slides. Look, it tells me there. It even knows. And we're coming up in an hour, so we're doing fine here. Okay, here's another one I'd like to see more of. Use client certificates to limit the attack surface, which is a nice term from Microsoft. I have secure servers at home. In the firewalls book, I told how I secured them and why I think they're secure. And many of them are SSL based. And I'd really like you to not get to even talk to the server until SSL says you're okay, which means I'd like to configure it with a series of client certificates, so only the machines I bless can log in. Why wouldn't this be great at a university or some other place? The problem is that even though computers handle client certificates, they usually don't have an interface. The Mac, for example, the Mac mailer, I know it has OpenSSL underneath in there. There's client certificate stuff in there someplace. Either it hasn't been brought out at a GUI or I've missed it or something. I'd like to put it in there. If someone knows how that works, this is what I love about giving talks because it's cheap research. I say, can anyone help me with this? And I've got a human search engine out there. We ought to do this a lot more. It limits who can actually connect successfully to services, and that cuts down on all the bad guys. Yeah, but. Yeah, but Chez, these ideas take time to deploy. There's a huge installed base. We have the corporate conglomerates have hundreds or thousands of these. Who owns the app you want me to replace? Who hosts it? Are there third-party applications? These comments, by the way, are direct from Ed Amoroso, CSO at AT&T. Who developed it? They're long gone. They work for Google now. What is the business function? I need a buy-in from all the parties before I can change this stuff. What are the development costs? Who are going to pay for it? Well, Ed, you should fix it anyway. When you did the merger, you said the big chunk of money at the beginning was to consolidate and cut costs. This is one of the places where you should do it. If you don't have your authentication server unified in a company, you don't know who your employees are from a computational point of view. Do it. Make it work. How can you do security if you don't know who they are in the first place? Also, you want to fix it because annoyed users are uncooperative users. And there's a cost, and the large community has to deal with this on a routine basis. How many people are sitting around batting away at problems like this? I don't have business cards right now. I've tried 3 times to order them since June, and I finally figured out 3 weeks ago that the reason was that I wasn't connecting with Internet Explorer version 7. I was running version 8. I'm sorry, that's too new for us. And the failure mode was such that it just didn't take my order. I finally had to run the right system and do that. So I'm hoping my business cards are waiting when I get back. I'm almost at the fit stage where I'll answer one of those spam mails and say, yes, please give me 500 beautiful business cards. What you really want is strong authentication, not strong passwords. Multi-factor authentication when you can do it. Laptops and cell phones are useful tools. We didn't always carry them around. Weaker passwords work. Weaker PINs work. I've had an ATM card now of one sort or another since about 1973, and they've always required 4 digits. Now, this is for someone in the street to walk up and take money out of a bank, and 4 digits is fine. Why is it fine? Because it eats the card after 4 attempts. This works, okay? And all we don't need to eat the card. We just need to be a little more sophisticated. It cuts user support costs. Backup passwords are weaker, it improves the user's experience, and if it helps, tell them I said it was a good idea. Number 98 on the list. So distribute client and use client certificates, use SSH without passphrases, use crypto services like IMAP and SMTPS, limit password attempts, and frankly, people, we have to do better than this. This is Mickey Mouse stuff we knew how to fix, or at least knew was a problem 30 years ago. The bad guys are getting much better, and we're getting screwed. Our computer systems are much more important, and security has to be thought about and reviewed. And here are some things I worry about. Dangerous browsing, dangerous patches, dangerous caught CPUs, hidden malware, and the bad guys are pros. They're just as good as you are, if not better. Dangerous browsing. All your iframes point to us. A lovely paper from Google that points out that even if you go to righteous websites, you may still get hacked. Dangerous patches. The MacArthur Award-winning Song Chung. Dawn Song. Whoa, I swapped out on that one. Automatic patch exploit generation is possible. You look at the patches and figure out what was wrong and automatically generate an exploit. How about that? It takes a few CPU seconds. They can even tell about the repairs that don't fix the problem. Provably hidden malware. Same swell folks. Well, same on how to really make the malware resistant to detection. Dangerous CPUs. Well, we've always known that if someone in the supply chain messes with things, it can be bad. This particular paper took a Spark 7 description, and their question was, how many transistors do I have to change or add to make the CPU mine? And the answer was 0.5% of the transistors. But that isn't what really got me out of this paper. What really nailed me was the way you'd activate it. You send the CPU a UDP packet with a very carefully set, specified list of contents and a bad checksum. The CPU is looking at this pattern of bits, which can be cryptographically strong, and says, oh, it's time for me to turn off my memory protection mechanism. And then it hits the checksum and says, oh, this is a bad checksum. I'll throw the packet away. Huh? How am I going to detect this? It's a bad packet. I might not even detect it in my sniffer. This is the sort of stuff that they can do. And of course, what I really need to add to this is Stuxnet. I mean, This is important. Yeah, holy smokes. With this kind of stuff, why are we still worried about I have nude passwords? Thank you for your attention. We have half an hour for questions.
Well, of course, I'm Rick Farrow.
Yeah, I couldn't help but jump in there in the middle. I'm sorry for the interruption.
No, that's okay. I relish that. I come from 1127.
Yes, indeed. So
Wait, I have to switch to far-seeing now. Okay.
Oh, thank you. I'm now on your radar.
Yes.
I spent way too many years talking to guys who were like the baseball players. So I used to teach classes for Computer Security Institute, and before that, some even less reputable organization. And so I'd have these people in the class, and I'd be saying, you really want to use Secure ID, something like this. I had examples. I'd pull them out. I'd get people in the class to show them. And every time I did this, I'd have people go, well, yeah, we looked at that. One example you alluded to was, well, we're the natural gas provider in L.A., and we really want people to log into their accounts and see what's going on. And we looked at doing something like this. We have 10 million customers.
Yeah. I'm not impressed so far. Keep going.
Okay. Well, that was one complaint. You covered that.
Well, so what was the complaint? That they have 10 million customers?
Yeah. That the support cost alone would be in the millions of dollars a year, for the support.
And we need to look at that some more.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that has to do with the authentication server issue, which was a big problem for a lot of people. They were mainly just bitching because Secure ID, the dongles were fairly cheap, but the server was outrageous.
Well, that is something. It's very nice to roll your own server. That's what we did at the labs. Mm-hmm. And the software out there is available if you want to do your own. Not for the RSA stuff, but you can certainly emulate the challenge response thing with apps of your own. And I have a little project I'm working on with a student from Cornell that I hope will create the client end for another one, maybe using the pass graphs.
Yeah, and there were things like S-key. Mm-hmm. So, and I guess the story about the lost dongle, that was somebody who like shows up in Hong Kong. It's Monday in Hong Kong. They need to be doing work, but I'm sorry, they've crossed the dateline. So it's Sunday morning,
yep.
And there's nobody there to help them, and they can't do their presentation or whatever. These are the usual, like, the dog ate my homework excuses people would give for not doing this. So there's been a huge amount of resistance.
You ever got off the train and found you didn't have your car keys?
Yeah, well, not the training, but yeah.
It's the same problem, isn't mm-hmm. it, really?
Yeah, it is really similar.
And maybe you can do some temporary thing to get them in, a phone call, and, okay, for the next 10 minutes, the password frog works for you. You can mm-hmm. imagine ad hoc solution, not ad hoc, but emergency holographic solutions that could work with a human in the loop. It's not ideal. On the other hand, what we have now has people using the backup password so often. I mean, I just don't even try to remember sometimes. They say, I'm logging into this place. I don't know, remember my username or my password, but I'll muddle through. And a few emails later, we've recovered it, and it's just a pain in the neck. And you know, I end up calling them sometimes. And that I think that part could go away and make some savings.
Okay, I just want to conclude with one thing.
Yes.
You know, my way too many years of doing this. I mean, it was between 94 and 2003 I was doing this. What I discovered is most of the people in IT were like Babe Ruth.
Yes.
They were not like the people in this room, and I think that's a big part of the problem. And these are the people who are running the systems, not the people who are using them.
Right. In the back is the next one.
So Paul Krizak from AMD. I've noticed that the trend, at least for me, when I've started to log into things that I'm really concerned about being secure, banks, stuff like that, many, many of them have switched to the site key model, where you have a username and a password, and then it takes you to a second screen where it shows you a number of pictures, and it says, is this your site key? And then you have to confirm to move on. Do you feel like that's adding more security, less security? I can't really get a feel on it. It just seems kind of irritating to me.
No, it is a really nice defense against phishing because the phishers don't know what picture to give you. So if grandma is used to picking out her picture in step two, she can't be phished because those guys won't know what she has without more stuff. So I think that's actually a good idea. It's adding some human certificate processing in some sense.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yes. Jay Faulkner from Rackspace. As a follow-up to what Rick was asking, anyone right now who is using, who's playing the new Final Fantasy MMORPG or has a Blizzard Battle.net account has the option, and in fact with Final Fantasy I'm pretty sure it's the default, to get an RSA token for a login, and that's for gaming accounts. So I absolutely do agree that, that we have to get better and not deal with simple passwords anymore. So thank you.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, oh, the same faces. Yes, Mark.
I just have a comment, and that is I'm a little pessimistic that things are ever going to get better. And to give you an example why, our most recently acquired large computing resource came from a vendor who I'll be charitable and not name publicly. They installed it knowing it was going to be in public IP space. We normally don't use password-based logins. It's SSH public key authentication only. However, they enabled it, despite the fact that we told them we don't use password-based logins. And they created an account named admin, whose password was 123456.
Oh. Oh, great.
We didn't realize any of this until one day I noticed that, who the hell logged in from Romania? We were incredibly lucky because this happened and was discovered about 2 weeks before that sequence of four or five or six local privilege escalation exploits that came out for, that were revealed for Linux a number of weeks ago. But if a major computer vendor is going to do something that lame, how can we expect everybody else to get it right?
This is why I'm doing a lot of work in visualization and text processing. You know, we were asking questions like this 20 years ago. You know, how could Microsoft come out with this brand new Windows 95 and have all those network services turned on? We already knew that was a bad idea. I don't know. We keep struggling. You know, maybe if I tell them, maybe they'll make a difference. I don't know. Yep, you're next.
Oh, I'm next. Hi, I'm Joel Huddleston. I work for Northrop Grumman. I'm wondering if you're familiar of the work with Yubico, a company out of Finland, I think. They have a USB dongle that has one button on it. Authenticate me. It looks like a keyboard to the system. And I was wondering if you knew anything about it.
I don't know about that particular product. Obviously, the fact that we've got a USB there is an attractive idea. I'm not sure the button's good enough, because if my client is taken over, what have I just given credentials to? You really need a trust to do this. If you're thinking through all the steps, you really need a trusted path to the dongle. It needs to have a little screen and a little button so you know you're talking to it. I assume there's a pin involved somewhere in this somehow.
I'm not exactly sure what.
I mean, there should be, right? Otherwise, I just steal it and plug it in, and I'm you. But if how do I get that pin into it without going through a possibly corrupted client? You get down this, there's a whole track of questions you have to ask, but I think the general approach is a great idea. And for grandma, maybe a button is good enough.
Probably.
You know, and that's a lot, saying a lot. And it's probably pretty cheap, I would guess.
Yeah.
Except the server end isn't, is it?
They actually give you open source tools to work
very
with.
Very nice. Okay. Well, I'm neither supporting nor denying support for this particular product, but it sounds promising. Yes.
Mark Stavely, independent. Chez, we've had this conversation lots of times before. I mean, what did you call it? The authentication ball of hell or something?
The big ball of authentication.
Yeah, I mean, I just checked my personal password vault, which has 215 entries, and that's only my level 3 passwords, which is, by the way, secured with my level 4 password. It is only used for that. That's not counting all the accounts that I do, in fact, let Firefox say, yeah, remember this, all
maybe
my level 1s.
You're spending too much time online. Sorry, that was a cheap
maybe,
shot. Go on. I got my laugh.
Maybe.
Yeah.
How do we get past, from a user standpoint, I mean, dongles are nice. I mean, we all understand how to make this, well, we don't understand, but you understand and that how to make this better. But the problem is, you know, unless we go to something like OpenID, you know, there's just too many of them.
So go to OpenID. Most of those probably would work just fine if we trusted Google's authentication. You know, and they say, you want to talk here, Talk to the Google hand. If they say it's okay, you know, the crypto in principle can work, so that whole arrangement's pretty secure. And then you just have to pick this for various values of Google.
I'm perfectly on board with that.
Right. But
next question.
Yes.
Where are the slides?
Where
are the slides? At your place or at AT&T?
Well, I don't know about Usenix yet. I don't know if Usenix wants them, but they're certainly welcome to have them. They do want them, so the PDF will be up. This talk is a slight modification of one I've given over the last 2 years, so you can probably download 4 different versions from my website right now, and I'll put this up later today, so it'll be there as well. And my Cheswick.com, and if you can't find it from that, you shouldn't be reading this stuff anyway. And I guess that's it. Thank you all. This was a lot of fun.